Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and a very warm welcome to today's broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick and I'll be with you for the next half hour. Coming up in a few moments, spotlight on relations between the Holy See and the United States. The papal court at the time of the visit of the first Catholic president of the United States, John Fitzgerald Kennedy. And a programme by the title of Apartheid and After, Three Generations of South Africans Tell Their Story. Diplomatic relations between the Holy See and the United States. That's the expertise of our guest today. He's historian from the University of Virginia in the United States, Professor Gerald Fogarty.
Yes, it really began with my dissertation when I was a graduate student. Then I realized that almost nobody worked on it. My dissertation was on this movement called Americanism at the end of the 19th century. It had to do with religious liberty, but religious liberty in the United States was never condemned by the Holy See. They came close, but they never did. So therefore, what happened at Vatican II with religious liberty represented a development of theology, not so much real development of doctrine. But right after the American Revolution, there were overtures made by the Holy See's government to the minister to France, who happened to be Benjamin Franklin, who had no religion whatsoever, but he was the United States minister to France, whether or not his country, his government, had any objection to the appointment of a bishop or an appointment of a foreign bishop from France in particular. It was very vague, typical of that language. Well, he said this is a religious matter and doesn't concern us, but nevertheless he forwarded it to the United States Congress, which was the supreme governing body at that time until the United States Constitution was adopted in 1789. This occurred in 1783. And the president of Congress at the time was James Madison, and he wrote back that this was a religious matter, which technically was really left to the states, but not the United States government. Even our First Amendment talks about Congress shall make no laws.
Now you've painted the background to the picture. Why don't we paint in the key players, beginning with the popes, of course, Pius IX?
He appeared at first to be progressive. So the United States established ministerial relations with the papal states. Now that lasted until 1867, at which point, because of this radical Congress that we've spoken about before, what they call the radical Reconstructionists, they cut off funding for that in 1867, beginning for fiscal 1868. The same time they cut off funding for an American minister to Portugal. Now, by the way, I'm using the term minister because the United States had no ambassadors anywhere until the 1890s, because it was following through on the first president's notion, George Washington's notion, there should be no entangling alliances. So as a result of it, we had the lower grade of diplomatic mission, as did the United Kingdom with the Holy See from 1915 until 1982. They had a minister. Yeah, they didn't have an ambassador. So the term is still there, but that's why the United States didn't have any ambassadors until the 1890s. You can find this on the United States State Department's homepage for heads of missions.
So the United States continued, technically speaking, anyway.
It became a very heated problem. It was suggested during World War I, but put down immediately.
The next step in this process was Cardinal Pacelli, the future Pius XII.
It came up again in 1936 when Cardinal Pacelli paid a visit to the United States. And Bishop Spellman at that time had been working on this since 1932. And so was the apostolic delegate, Umberto Cicognani, at the time. He was talking to the president by May of 1933 about the possibility of diplomatic relations. And Roosevelt was sort of, frankly, playing along with the Catholics. He addressed Archbishop Cicognani at one point as Mr. Ambassador and then said, I hope soon that will be your title. Of course, it wouldn't have been, but nevertheless, he obviously was playing to Cicognani and through Cicognani to the Holy See, because that was reported back to Pacelli.
What you're saying, Catholics weren't exactly popular in the United States at that time.
In 1928, there had been a very painful election. Governor Al Smith, a Catholic of New York, was nominated as the Democratic candidate, and he was defeated mainly because of the Catholic issue. Although, strangely, he carried the states in the Deep South, where there was much more prejudice. The Upper South, states like Kentucky, Tennessee, Virginia, were not covered.
So what happened during World War II? Any progress made on the path to improving diplomatic relations?
A compromise during the war period by appointing a personal representative. His name was Myron Taylor. But When the war broke out, he had an assistant, Harold Tittman, and he had to have some diplomatic title to allow him to move into the Vatican with other Allied diplomats. So he was named chargé d'affaires. So technically speaking, that does mean diplomatic relations.
And after the war?
Now, in 1950, Myron Taylor resigned, and the United States never informed the Vatican. They just closed the office down. So that's where it stood. In 1951, President Truman did nominate General Mark Clark as the ambassador to the Vatican. There is no such entity for diplomatic purposes. It's to the Holy See. And there was no chance of his ever being approved because the chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, which would have to approve this to get it on the floor of the Senate would have to give its approval for the appointment of an ambassador. And the chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee was a senator from Texas. Texans hated General Clark because he had used the 36th Texas Infantry Division in the Battle of the Rapido River, and it was decimated, literally. So they thought he was a butcher. So there's no chance of his nomination ever going through, although he did have good relations with the Holy See. In 1954, Truman said that he was in favor. By that time, he was out of office. It became one of the two crucial issues in the campaign of John Kennedy for president of the United States. Was he in favor of diplomatic relations with the Vatican? And was he in favor of financial federal aid to parochial schools?
Of course, John Kennedy was the first Catholic president of the United States.
He was the first Catholic president, the second one to run. And he said in regard to relations with the Vatican, stressing that because they used that term, he was opposed to it because the turmoil surrounding approval of an ambassador would undermine any benefit that it may have. In regard to aid to parochial schools, he said that he would have to follow the Constitution. I always like to use the distinction when somebody says it's unconstitutional. Well, that's the interpretation of the Supreme Court. But the Supreme Court has been known to change. So therefore, I prefer to say the interpretation given by the Supreme Court. But anyway, that's where the question rested then, and there was hesitation as to whether or not the president could even have any type of meeting with the Pope. He actually did come over and meet with Paul VI. They tested it ahead of time because his vice president, Lyndon Johnson, had been to see the Pope, and then Jacqueline Kennedy came, and there was no real upheaval because John the 23rd presented a different image of the church and so forth and so on.
And that's the end of part one of Professor and Jesuit Gerald Fogarty's explanation of diplomatic relations between the Holy See and the United States. As I'm sure you noticed, I interrupted Professor Fogarty right when he was speaking about John Fitzgerald Kennedy. What I'd like to do now is bring you an impression of the Vatican in 1963. When President John Fitzgerald Kennedy came to Rome following the coronation ceremony of Paul VI on June the 21st, 1963. A ceremony to which this United States president sent a delegation before travelling to the Vatican himself to meet with the Pope less than a month later. It was July the 2nd. In a few moments, I'll be touching on that meeting, but above all, highlighting the pomp and circumstance of the papal court in the Vatican at the time, abolished in great part by Paul VI, who'd just been crowned with a triple crown. Let's listen.
Accipe tiaram tribus coronis ornatam, et scias te esse padrem principum et regum.
Well, the coronation of Pope Paul VI was done with the full splendor of the medieval ceremony in front of St. Peter's, I remember. It was a very hot day, and that was the last time there was absolutely everything there. Another remarkable figure was the...
On June the 30th, 1963, Winston Churchill's first cousin, Sir John Leslie, whose father was supernumerary chamberlain to Pius XI, was present in St. Peter's Square for Paul VI's coronation. It was the last time a pope was ever to be crowned.
I think the Queen of Saxony have the privilege of wearing white with the pope, and ladies wore long dresses with black veils and tiaras. The Roman nobility then had front seats. But as soon as Pope Paul came in, so many things were done away with.
We witnessed the industry, the imagination and the dedication which have transformed the vast riches of your natural resources into a very high standard of living for you citizens.
2 days after his enthronement, Paul VI met with America's first Catholic president, John Fitzgerald Kennedy.
Has not forgotten the high ideals of its first beginnings, nor neglected the poorer.
While the world the young American president represented was modern, vital, and projected into the 21st century, it clashed with the pomp and ceremony of a Vatican still deeply anchored in the past. The new pope was determined to change that. He was an intellectual and very aware it was time to bring the church closer to the modern world. His attempts to do so would not always be understood.
We thought he was a bit austere and puritanical in a kind of way, but efficient. But he abolished so many things, the Palatine Guard, the Noble Guard, and countless things in the church. I remember Monsignor Hemick saying he's abolishing everything. And he steered the church through a very difficult time in a magnificent manner, you might say.
When Paul VI decided someday to reduce or almost suppress the papal court and its military asset.
Count Carlo Cardelli belonged to the papal court abolished by Paul VI.
And some of the unnecessary pageantry. He also suppressed the annual audience for the Roman families, together with the special tribune at the ceremonies. In an unforgettable audience, January 64, he said that now that the Pope was no more a temporal sovereign and that the Church was more and more universal, some of the past privileges could not be maintained. Not forgetting all the past services and merits of our families, the Church had now nothing more to offer. An unfortunate expression. I heard an aged lady near me whisper, "But Holy Father, we have only given." In our families, we had always been taught not to criticize the Holy Father or to express preferences for one or another pope. He was the Vicar of Christ, his representative. But the suppression of this privilege, a word that seemed to frighten the pope, was a hard blow. After that, there is a feeling that our families ceased to be as a group, having lost this personal link with the Holy Father. Besides, since then, the choice and the quality of the papal court has lost a great deal. And now people go there in blue jeans and as they like. Before, we were very strict and we had to go in full dress.
And of course, in those days, the Pope was carried on his sedia gestatoria, the chair which allowed him to be viewed by the people in the crowd. In one way, perhaps it was better.
On September the 29th, 1963, a young priest named John Foley, later to become cardinal, was in St. Peter's Basilica reporting on the opening ceremony of the second session of the Second Vatican Council.
See him clearly. And the silver trumpets from the back window of St. Peter's, way up high, would play the papal hymn as the Pope was carried up the middle aisle. With the stands that were erected for the Second Vatican Council, with assigned seats for each cardinal and bishop and patriarch, it was a magnificent sight. All of the cardinals and bishops would be dressed in copes and mitres, and the Eastern Rite bishops in crown. So you can imagine what that looked like in a procession like that, about 2,000 bishops. I would think that its like may never be seen again, because the number of bishops has grown so greatly, and the expense of such events would have grown greatly. And as I said, it was very easy to see the Holy Father in that situation. In those days, of course, also, the Pope wore a crown, a tiara, the triple crown.
A triple crown, Paul VI felt, was no longer in keeping with the times. He was soon to give it away, cancelling yet another of the Catholic Church's centuries-old traditions. Carmelite father Redemptus Fallerbeck recalled the enormous impact this clamorous gesture had on public opinion.
I remember very well a tense moment because, of course, this was centuries of tradition, and many of the more traditional-minded people didn't like it. Even, I think, some of the people who had contributed that terror to him, I think they were the people of Milan, they were kind of hurt that he would give away something that they sacrificed for to give. But his gesture really was in a different direction. He wanted to divest the papacy of some of those regal trappings. So it was really a much broader gesture than just the tiara.
I was with him so often, day after day, sometimes more than once a day, certainly every week for a number of occasions. I was able to see and admire the way that he led the church. Pope Paul made
in the 1970s, Archbishop Justin Regali was a young priest serving as a translator in English to Pope Paul VI. The nature of his work enabled him to follow firsthand the issues and decisions that were close to Papa Montini's heart.
He was a man of great hope, great compassion, and certainly had a wonderful love for the church and a wonderful love for the individuals in the church.
The many churches that dot the American countryside and despise reaching high over the cities are indicative of the spiritual awareness and conviction of your people.
Pope Paul VI came in October of 1965 to New York. It was the first visit of a pope to the United Nations. It was a very historic occasion. Pope Paul made, in French, an impassioned plea for peace. Jamais la guerre, jamais plus la guerre, never war, no more war. And it was stirring. You could see that the people there were deeply touched. I think that even some of the people from communist states felt the power of what he was saying.
Jamais plus la guerre, jamais plus la guerre. C'est la paix qui doit garder le destin des peuples.
Finally, I'd like to mark Nelson Mandela Day, which was celebrated across the world this past week on July the 18th, a date established by the United Nations in 2009 as a call to action for people everywhere to take responsibility for making the world a better place. I'd like to do this by sharing with you the final part in a series by the title of Apartheid and After, a result of a UNICEF-sponsored fact-finding mission to South Africa, which took place 2 years after Mandela had been elected as president of this nation in 1994. A journey which took me, among other places, to the southwestern township of Soweto. And if you stay tuned, you can hear the witness of three different generations of black South Africans, and also that of a white Maoris brother.
I remember as kids, we didn't know anything about ANC and Tambo, anything.
I was also involved with the Mandela group and all that, and sometimes I went also hiding.
We can forgive people, but not to forget.
These are the voices of three different generations of black South Africans. Peter Dada, a 58-year-old man from Soweto who struggled against apartheid all his life. Pinky Vilakazi, who belongs to the generation of township students that brought the apartheid system to its heel. And Queenef, a 16-year-old, is old enough to know the meaning of apartheid.
I remember as kids, we didn't know anything about ANC and Tambo, but the way the community, everybody made sure that children grow up knowing there's Nelson Mandela, there's Oliver Tambo. Just to know there are such people on earth was one of the best things to keep us hoping.
I was also involved with the Mandela group and all that, and sometimes I went for hiding when policemen were harassing us and chasing us around to be arrested. So I went to Portuguese East Africa by then, before Maputo, and I stayed there for 2 weeks. And try to come back again and I only find the message that the policemen still are looking for me. Then I went to Botswana, where I spent another 2 weeks there. But the home sweet home, you always look forward to come back.
Do you think you owe something to these people who died in the struggle against apartheid?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Oh, yes. We have to respect them. We have to remember them. Because those are the people which they strive very hard to see that we get into this freedom.
Haven't you got any anger?
Not at all. No, no. We should forgive and forget and start afresh. Moreover, the young ones, they are going to take over. They're the future of tomorrow. We already, time is expired. We won't enjoy anything. They are going to enjoy the fuller democracy country more than we.
Yeah, definitely. I think a person should forgive but never forget. Someone asks you to forget, that person is asking you to like give up something. So I think we can forgive people but not to forget.
Three generations of black South Africans are recounting their personal stories there, but that prompts the question, where were the white South Africans while the struggle against apartheid was underway? And where was the Catholic Church?
Apartheid was so successful in so many ways. It isolated you from so much in the country. I mean, many people today say, you know, where was I when these things were happening? It's difficult even to understand that question because people struggle with that question themselves. Where was I when these things happened? What was I doing at that time? I think it was only in the late 60s, early 70s that I started to get a consciousness of what was going on in this country. Strange as that may seem. I mean, it took us from the middle of 1975 through until 1989 to get the school situation actually recognized by the government. Certainly in the mid-70s, there was no certainty about being successful on this at all.
Brother Jude Peterson expresses a sense of surprise, almost of disbelief, one shared by black people as well.
Pinky was convinced that the apartheid system would never crumble, although her own daughter of 9 has adapted so easily that she makes her own mother feel embarrassed. You'll see why. Like everyone else, Pinky never imagined she'd live to see Mandela free.
See him go out was just such a disempowering event to the extent that I never thought I would see this moment. I thought maybe my children or my grandchildren. Both my kids have not been exposed to sort of black and white issues as my husband and I were, especially the little one. Sometimes I don't even think she realizes that she's black.
Today, Pinky's children belong to an all-new generation of South Africans. They go to integrated schools of high achievement results. But Pinky's careful to say this is not the rule. She tells me with dismay that the first school her 12-year-old daughter went to was the same one she and her husband fought so hard to improve.
I always think I'm part of the whole transitional phase in South Africa. As a young student, I'm one of those people who throw stones and all those things. So I've seen some of it, though not at all. I mean, we threw those stones, I saw my friends die, my own colleagues in the classroom. When I think back, like they happened yesterday, there was no way you could say it's for the political thing. We didn't take it as political. We were just fighting our own students' wars, though the whole thing just spread like fire. So growing up, getting married one day to my husband, whom I met in the same university, throwing stone with him, having my first daughter, one day having to take her to a school, the same desk that my husband sat on, the same broken windows, no doors. Can you imagine what it made me feel as a parent? What did I achieve? I didn't see the change. All the things are still seen in black and white. There's not going to be any miracle. More than anything, we also need patience because people just thought the inauguration of the president will just change everything. And unfortunately, that's not true. With all the resources, with all the willingness, with all the good intentions, nothing is going to be achieved overnight.
But still, people like Peter Dadla and his generation consider that something has changed since the days of apartheid when you couldn't even sleep at night.
It was difficult because you couldn't sleep because you've been searched, you've been keep on being hunted by police. If you're running and they said stop, you don't stop, you could be killed. It's better when it's daytime more than nighttime because nighttime is where you get the most policemen searching, going each and every house looking for whatever pamphlet. newspaper they could find concerning about struggle or anything. Even some other books which I had, I'll have to just burn them and forget about them. Funny enough, now you could see those books they've been reading in the street all over.
They were all white policemen who used to chase you?
A lot of white and some dangerous black, but most of the blacks, they used to kill them once they could see them around in our place.
The black policemen used to be killed by you?
Yes, the black policemen will be killed instantly.
Do you think this violence was justified?
It's not at all. It's not at all. It's something behind it. It's not that black people, they would like to kill each other. It's some other bad element which they go in and then they start to fight. Moreover, like these whites which are being arrested, because they will paint themselves, make themselves black and come into the place where the black stays and start to shoot around people. And then later on, then they will have that gossip left behind that these are the other people on the other side trying to kill you. So then that will be black to black.
I think somehow apartheid had worked very hard on making us feel very dehumanized, very incompetent. Just the mere skin of your color would make you the most hopeless thing on earth. Not capable. I'm sure you'd remember the mind guy, Ari Paulus, who went on public to say the black skin has no mind inside. It can't think. So some of those things were so demoralizing that somehow, if you hear those lies over and over again, maybe you'd end up believing that there's something wrong with this color. But very soon I started believing that, boy, I'm beautiful, I'm capable of anything that anyone can do.
Looking at the apartheid legacy, what has been achieved has gone down in history. But one can't help asking oneself, what if Mandela had died in prison?
And as an elder student now in university, my fear was that if he could die in prison, there would be the worst of wars. Nobody would stop anybody. If it had happened during the 70s, people were just saying, each time he would be admitted to hospitals, the student would just say, let him die there. Then you'll get what you were asking for.
Mandela, he came in at the right time, where we were just looking forward that maybe we might not see what we are seeing today. Instead, it was going to be a real bloodbath.
What about the future?
Oh, the future is holding a lot, as I can see, because now got a free democratic country, you do as you please, but I think we're quite living in a better place that we never expected to live in.
What do you think of white people?
Well, I think of white people equally because I've got white friends and I enjoy their company more than African people because we've got some differences and you share different personality and so that I like most about whites.
Has something really changed? Really, really changed?
Yes, a lot. Because since the democratic elections and everything, we can speak to people, work together. I think it's very nice.
And that brings me up to time. I do hope you enjoyed this broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick. Thanks so much for listening. Don't forget, we'll be back again at the same time tomorrow, so be sure to join us then. Meanwhile, should you wish to check out our website, the address is www.vaticanradio.va. Bye for now. You've been listening to the English program of Vatican Radio. Laudetur Jesus Christus.